Case number 19-5343, Andrew H. Roar, appellant versus Steve Jurczyk in his official capacity as the acting administrator of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Ms. Robinette, amicus curiae for the appellant, Mr. Roar, pro se appellant, Ms. Palmer Ball for the appellee.
Good morning, counsel. Ms. Robinette, please proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, your honors, and may it please the court. My name is Catherine Robinette, amicus for appellant Mr. Farrar. The narrow issue before this court is whether a plaintiff seeking a de novo trial in this court must return his administrative award before being permitted to initiate his civil action. Because neither the Rehabilitation Act, the incorporated provisions of Title VII, nor case law from this court impose such a requirement, the district court erred in dismissing Mr. Farrar's complaint. First, there's no dispute in this case that Mr. Farrar seeks de novo review and that therefore he must prove both liability and entitlement to his requested relief. The government acknowledged that both in its motion to dismiss below and its briefings here. Because Mr. Farrar seeks de novo review, Scott does not govern. There was no ambiguity in Scott that the plaintiff explicitly argued that he was not required to relitigate liability in the district court. That is not the case here. And there's no authority for the proposition that simply maintaining the status quo during the pendency of litigation by retaining an administrative award imposes a substantive bar to civil action. The only other federal appellate court to address this issue, the Fifth Circuit in Massengill, held that the retention of an administrative award was not a bar to initiating a civil action in district court.
Ms. Robinette, the Fifth Circuit said that if the plaintiff in that case loses his federal court suit, then that plaintiff likely would have to give back the award that was received during the administrative adjudication. Do you agree that Mr. Farrar will have to give back his entire award that he has received if he loses his civil suit at the district court?
Yes, Judge Walker. We're not arguing that Mr. Farrar would not be required to return his administrative award if he ultimately was unsuccessful in the district court in this case. We're simply arguing that failing to disgorge the award now before initiating civil action imposed a substantive bar to him initiating his proceeding here. So our ask is fairly narrow that Mr. Farrar not be required to disgorge the award prematurely or before initiating civil action. But we do not argue that he, if ultimately unsuccessful, would have to return his administrative award.
How much was it? My impression is that there was 25,000 plus 8,000. Is that ballpark correct?
Ballpark, that's correct. I believe there are attorney's fees as well. I don't know if that's included in that amount, but that sounds.
And if you could expand a little bit on your theory for why the government is not already entitled to that money, and why the government didn't become entitled to that money the moment that he filed this civil suit, which could be viewed as a rejection of the EEOC adjudication. I'm not saying that he would necessarily have to write them a check, but if the government were to bring their own suit to recoup that money today, tell me why the government shouldn't win that suit immediately.
I guess I would say, I think the government in this or any other case where this is where this happens, has tools at its disposal to work out with the parties some sort of arrangement to place the monies in escrow during the pendency of the litigation. I don't think anything prohibits the government from seeking to do something like that. As I said, we're just arguing that the mere acceptance didn't bar his action.
Assume I agree with you on that, but I think that he lost any entitlement to the money as soon as he filed this suit. Maybe you agree with me that the government can file their own suit or a counterclaim to his suit and is entitled to get that money back immediately because he rejected that money by filing this suit?
Yeah, I mean, candidly, I haven't thought through the entitlement, you know, to the funds issue at the present moment thoroughly enough, I think, to say.
Okay. But I thought, didn't Massengill itself contemplate a counterclaim?
I believe the court there did, yes.
So then if there's an opportunity to file, if your argument is that we should adopt the approach in Massengill, and Massengill, as I recall, correct me if I'm wrong, but as I recall, the opinion closes by contemplating that the government could file a counterclaim, then there'd be a question about how ripe the counterclaim would be and exactly when the entitlement to prevail on the counterclaim and get the money back kicks in. But at that point in time, the government would have asserted its entitlement to get the money back. And then there'd be a temporal question about when the court actually renders the award of the counterclaim, and does it have to wait till the end of the suit for the claim itself and the counterclaim? I haven't purported to work any of that out in my mind, but I take it that the counterclaim is there as an opportunity for the government.
That's right. And Massengill certainly contemplated the possibility of a counterclaim and didn't opine as to the timing question that you raised, which I agree is a tricky one.
Can I follow up on one aspect of what Judge Walker is asking about, which is, so a counterclaim is one possibility that Massengill itself contemplated. And you could also contemplate a scenario in which the government would adopt some sort of regulatory apparatus, regulations or something, that would provide for, you know, a requirement for a party who brings a suit to put, as you said, put money in escrow, or I don't know exactly how they would work it out. But in theory, the government could adopt a regulatory regime that addressed some of the issues that are in play here. And I just didn't know whether you'd given any thought to, I know that you're arguing here in your capacity as court appointed amicus, but have you given thought to whether that kind of regulatory apparatus would be something that's within the government's authority to do?
I think it would. And I think the regulation that the court's aware of and directed us to yesterday evening, 29 CFR 1614.502, that regulation provides that agencies have 120 days after receipt of the final EEOC decision to provide the relief ordered. That rule was amended in 2012. Previously, the time allotted to agencies to provide relief was 60 days. So in 2012, the commission extended the time from 60 to 120 days, and they specifically noted in the preamble that change was made because the commission believed, quote, that agencies should not be required to provide relief before the expiration of the complainant's 90-day right to file suit. So I think the government's concerns about this somehow a rule allowing Mr. Farrar's suit to continue somehow opening the floodgates is unwarranted, given this regulation. And in the mine run of cases, we believe that the government has ample resources to protect itself by simply awaiting the expiration of the 90-day appeal period before it orders relief. I'll note that didn't happen in this case. The EEOC actually ordered relief provided within 60 days. I'm not sure why that is the case. I think the government could have certainly, I see that I'm out of time. May I complete the thought?
Yeah.
I think the agency could have requested reconsideration on that point if they sought to extend the period to 120 days to align with the regulation here. But I do think that this shows that concerns over, you know, floodgates are unwarranted given this regulation is already on the books.
So we can ask the government about the way this works in operation too, but to the extent that you're aware of it and have given thought to it, what happens in a situation in which what would happen in a situation in which the award has been entered so that we know how much is owed, but then there's no actual payment of the award within the 90-day period. Within the 120-day period, but at some point before the 90-day period, the suit is brought. And then how does that play out?
I'm not sure in practice. The regulation certainly contemplates, in the notes to the regulatory change certainly indicate that the change was made to protect agencies. So I would assume that in that scenario, the agency simply would not provide, would not make the payment, and the case would proceed in district court as we are here.
Okay. Let me make sure my colleagues don't have any additional questions for you, Ms. Robinette, at this point. We'll give you some rebuttal time. Thank you. Mr. Farrar.
Morning, if it may please the court. I'm Andrew Farrar. I'm advocating on my own behalf. I wanted to touch on this issue that's been brought up as far as the counterclaim with regard to Massengill. My fellow civil servant actually stated in their brief that it's not quite as simple as counterclaiming. And where I think that lies is that there is a jurisdictional issue with the Tucker Act. And if a rule were to issue that provided that the district court has the power to require the parties to stipulate to a counterclaim being remanded to the Federal Court of Claims as the result of a trial, that would be entirely consistent with Massengill, this circuit's precedents, and also West versus Gibson, which was where the Supreme Court was tasked with determining whether the EEOC had any authority at all to issue compensatory damages. And when that case was decided by the Supreme Court, it did recognize the possibility for a case similar to mine arising. And, it simply stuck to the language of the statute to say that, in the event it does happen where somebody's unsatisfied by the amount of money, they do have the right to proceed de novo. And I just think it's important to keep in mind that there are 2 million employees in the federal government, and to issue a rule that under, a doctrine of equitable mootness or something to that effect would risk consuming the entire statute. Thank you.
May I ask one question?
Absolutely.
Chief Judge,
of course.
I know the time. So Mr. Farrar, is there anything that the amicus said that you disagree with other than, aside from anything you've already said, anything the amicus said that you disagree with?
No, not that comes to mind. With respect to maybe the counterclaim, which I guess I elaborated that on that point. And I think you had asked why the government wouldn't have the right to immediately counterclaim. I think it's because it is tied to the right of a trial where, if the result of the trial is a lower award or no liability, then of course, I don't think anybody would have the right to continue to hold on to something that they had been adjudicated not to have a legal right to. I just think it's important to recognize that in judicial proceedings where you have to overcome maybe a motion to dismiss and summary judgment, someone hasn't actually lost their case until it goes to trial.
Thanks so much, Mr. Farrar.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let me make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions for you, Mr. Farrar. Thank you. Ms. Palmer-Bell.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Catherine Palmer-Ball, and I represent the appellee in this matter, Steve Jerzyk, in his official capacity as the administrator of NASA. One point I'd just like to make at the outset is to what the amicus stated as the government's position regarding the type of action Mr. Farrar seeks to bring here. I would not say that the government has conceded that Mr. Farrar's pleadings seek de novo review. I would say that we have assumed for the sake of argument that they do, and that even making that assumption, the acceptance and retention of the administrative remedy precludes him from proceeding in this suit at this time.
So just to be clear, so the practical consequence of that is that I think you have conceded it for purposes of appeal. You're just holding out your ability to make that argument in the district court if there were a remand. Is that where you're headed with that?
I think we would not say we have conceded it. We would find
I guess for my question is this: for our purposes as an appellate court, your brief comes to us without contesting that proposition. So for, I don't know if there's any practical distinction between a concession and an assumption as far as we're concerned. It seems to me that we're in the same place vis-a-vis the government, that we assume for our purposes, which is tantamount to a concession, that you're not disputing that point. Now, what you may or may not do with that on district court, where that's not in our bailiwick, but for our purposes, is there any practical difference?
No, we assume for purposes of this appeal.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure I wasn't missing where the government was. Okay.
Yes. Thanks. And we believe that under this court's holding in Scott, that a federal employee in the situation such as Mr. Farrar, who has prevailed at the administrative level and was awarded a remedy, has a choice. He can accept that disposition in the remedy, or alternatively, he can seek to bring a trial de novo in federal court. And having made that election, he should have to reject the all aspects of the administrative proceeding, including the remedy, in order to proceed. And part of the reason for that is that, you know, as I think the court has hinted at in these cases, that they can take some time, and that those remedies become more difficult to unwind with the passage of time. And so to save the way to go about this for the end of a case through a counterclaim, it really should be something that is decided at the beginning and upfront.
If, unless we're inventing such a rule on some sort of equitable grounds, I don't see a basis for that in the statute. Can you direct me to some language in any of the operative statutes that would require this procedure?
The government's position is that the term civil action in the statute is under Supreme Court precedent is a trial, means a trial de novo. And that is what our argument rests upon. And this court's holding in Scott that to seek a trial de novo under the circumstances should mean disgorgement of the remedy.
But Scott only said to seek a trial de novo means you have to seek a trial de novo, i.e. a trial on all of the issues. It doesn't say anything about disgorgement. What authority is there that disgorgement is part of trial de novo, and what trial de novo means? And doesn't our decision in Payne undermine your argument?
I think Scott did not face the precise issue presented here, but I think it very much follows from Scott and this the court's language in Scott that, you know, a employee has a choice to either accept the disposition in its award or to proceed with a de novo action.
Well, to the extent that there's a problem here, hasn't the EEOC resolved it with 29 CFR 1614.502?
Your Honor, with respect to the change to 120 days that was referenced, perhaps it was not that is not what happened in this case. In this case, the commission order did require the agency to comply within 60 days.
And the government could have asked for sought reconsideration of that, right?
Right, and the government did not seek reconsideration of that order in this case.
So, the EEOC is obviously, we should presume they're aware of their own regulations. The regulation says ordinarily you have 120 days unless the agency orders otherwise, unless we order otherwise. For whatever reason, in their wisdom, the EEOC made the award payable in 60 days here. Basically, to the extent that NASA is in a conundrum, it's in the conundrum because the EEOC decided, for whatever reason, that the award should be paid sooner than the 120 days. I mean, that's sounds like, you know, the rule contemplated that could happen. And I don't see why we as a court should try to unwind that?
I think the reason to do so is, you know, the court's holding in Scott and the nature of the trial de novo, and that the concept that it would not be fair to litigate anew the same determination while maintaining the benefits of the prior decision that you are seeking to that you've stepped away from.
One thing I don't quite follow about this is that it seems like the whole predicate of having this rule, the regulation adopted to give the government time. The idea is we want to expand the window so that the government can know before it has to pay up whether the complaining party is going to bring a suit. If the whole point of that was allowed to the government to make an intelligent decision about whether to pay, that seems to presume that there is no automatic entitlement, automatic requirement to disgorge by filing suit. Because if there were, then there wouldn't have been any reason to have the extended time window.
I think that, you know, as I say, it was not the situation that we're in this case. The NASA was faced with the choice, you know, and NASA was bound to comply with the EEOC order and did so. And it did not have, you know, the opportunity. That's the factual circumstances that this case has arisen in.
Ms. Palmer, Ball, I think that the government might have a common law equitable estoppel argument to block this suit based on Mr. Farrar's acceptance of the EEOC award. But you didn't argue common law equitable estoppel. My instinct is that that's probably a forfeited argument. Any reason why I should not treat that as a forfeited argument?
Your Honor, I think we did say, use language in our brief such that it would be fundamentally unfair to proceed in that manner. And to the extent, you know, that the court views that as encapsulating a kind of equitable estoppel argument, I think that argument was in our brief. I would note also that the regulation in subpart B does put forth different, I just thought it was an interesting comparison of the EEOC regulation, how they treat different aspects of relief. And the regulation does seem to take into account the same concern that NASA has put forth here about when it comes to a monetary remedy, you know, once the monetary remedy changes hands, it can be difficult to unwind that. And so it affords the agency the ability to delay the payment in under these circumstances where reconsideration is permitted. And I think the same principles could be drawn here.
But it seems significant then that the agency didn't avail itself of its right to seek reconsideration. I mean, if anything, the equities are against the government here because you didn't seek to use all the remedies that you had before the agency, before the EEOC.
The agency did not seek reconsideration. That's correct, Your Honor. But
and subsequently. So that would seem to be that if you had an opportunity to seek relief from having to pay out the money and you didn't, and then you come here and you say to us, this is all unfair, but you sat on your rights below, that would seem to counsel against the force of any equitable argument you can make before us.
I think the government's position is that Mr. Farrar reset everything when he sought a civil action de novo. And I see that I'm out of time. And I'm happy to answer any further questions, but if the panel doesn't have any, then we would request that
I have one quick question, which is how would this play out for non-monetary relief? So for example, if there were equitable relief in the nature of a reinstatement or something, I don't know how you disgorge a reinstatement. And if the person's back on the job, but there's some overarching principle that says you have to disgorge, what does that mean for non-monetary equitable forms of relief that might be bound up in the award that an agency, that the EEOC makes?
Yes, Your Honor, I think it does become a more difficult question when you consider different aspects of relief. The bright line rule that the government is advocating is that an individual would have to forswear all facets of the relief awarded. I think the EEOC regulation that the court drew the party's attention to last evening, it comes up with a way of differentiating between reinstatement versus monetary relief in subsection B, and it envisions a restoration to a position in a temporary or provisional capacity pending the outcome of the reconsideration. And so it treats those two elements of relief differently.
Right. I think the agency can construct a regulatory regime that takes account of these, but if there's some antecedent principle that's supposed to tell us that there's naturally an obligation to put yourself back to the position you were in before, it's just not entirely clear to me how that works out with non-monetary relief.
I think under the rule that the government advocates, it would have to be that you reject all aspects of the administrative remedy in order to challenge them.
Under the rule you adopt, it's not that you reject it. You would have, in other words, you don't think there was a problem with accepting it. It's that you think the problem is that having accepted it, you have to return it, right? That's, as I understand it, the government's position. It's not as if he was precluded from bringing suit the moment that he accepted, am I wrong?
No, he's not precluded from bringing suit. It's precluded from proceeding with the action until disgorgement occurs.
Until disgorgement. That's what I thought your position was. And then there becomes a question of how you do that when what you've accepted is not just monetary relief, but is other stuff too, as to which it's not as easy to contemplate how you return it.
Yes, I think, you know, the questions get more difficult, and I think it's within a district court's discretion as well how to set that in process moving forward with the suit.
Okay.
So if the EEOC orders reinstatement, it's done that because it found discrimination and it found that the employer wrongfully terminated the employee. And you believe that if the employee is going to challenge any part of the award, damages or attorney's fees or any part of the award, and therefore under Scott has to seek a trial de novo, then what has to happen is that the agency that the EEOC found acted unlawfully, basically, they get the status quo ante of their unlawful action according to the EEOC until the court decides, in that the employee gets no benefit at all of the EEOC determination.
Yes, Your Honor, pending the outcome of the district court action, it's the employee is required to prove liability anew. And so our position is that they have to step away from the remedy received and the underlying decision that they're challenging.
Thank you, Ms. Palmer-Ball. Let me make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions for you. Thank you. Ms. Robinette, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Just two quick points I wanted to make. It seems like a lot of what's animating the government's concern in this case are background assumptions or intuitions about a plaintiff's ability to repay should he ultimately be unsuccessful in this court. no matter how well-founded those assumptions or intuitions may be, we would posit that the court fashioning a legal rule based on those assumptions in the absence of any statutory authority or precedent. The second point pertains to trial de novo. We don't disagree with anything the government says about civil action or de novo review or what the plaintiff must prove before the district court. Our argument is that nothing about allowing a plaintiff to retain his administrative award impacts this court's ability to review the case in de novo, you know, and without deference to any previous findings, and undertake a de novo review of the action.
Thank you. Make sure my colleagues don't have questions for you on rebuttal. Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel. Ms. Robinette, you were appointed by the court to support appellant's arguments in this matter, and the court thanks you and your colleagues for your assistance.